Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on vitamin C, and this is mainstream medicine, telling us it's really good for us, including, intravenous vitamin C and cancer. I'll get to that. Also, if you live near a fracking site, bad news, air pollution is increasing the risk of health, and yet they said, no problem about air pollution. Yes, there is a problem. A special commentary today, murder is not an anomaly in war. It is war. Posted by Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. The latest on the environmental issues, including World Water Forum. Now, that sounds like an interesting place to be. Well, it was for 5,000 people, but it's not good for the rest of us because they want to privatize nature and undermine our rights to water, which is a human right. So who are these 5,000 people for the 6th World Water Forum in Marseille, France? I'll go into that. And what have I been saying so many times, and I really hope that we all join together on this one, stop all trading in any commodity essential to life. Make it against the law to have commodity trades, not more trades, but commodity trades where you're speculating and hence manipulating on anything essential such as food. That means all food, water, oil, gas. These are essential and currencies to our well-being. Well, they want to do just that. They want to be able to develop unhindered by any form of laws or rules how they can commodify water, and I'll go into that in some depth. Also, new scientific data forces the government to reverse its stance on fluoridation in our water supply. More information about cell phones, why they're harm to us. Another study yet. And sorry, Mr. Gates, genetically modified organisms are proven to be ineffective at fighting world hunger, and yet you've been going all over the planet telling us that's the reason you support it. You put hundreds of millions of dollars into it. You're the major, I believe, the single largest owner of a stock in Monsanto. Well, on this one, sir, you have wrong information. However, I spoke with Jeffrey Smith and Vandana Shiva and others. We would be happy to have a group of us who have knowledge of farming and sustainability meet with you directly, not your representatives, and to discuss with you why we would hope that as wealthy as you are, as a policymaker, that you would now shift your emphasis away from not just the folly of genetically modified organisms, but the whole idea that a few corporations bear DuPont, Monsanto, should own the world's seeds, because whoever owns the world's seeds controls its food, and whoever controls its food rules. I can't imagine that would be your motive. So, I'm asking you, meet with us. Pleasant, positive conversation. There are five of us. Each one has a background and expertise in organic farming. I'm a certified organic farmer and have a lot of experience. And Jeffrey Smith in the dangers of genetically modified seed, Vandana Shiva in showing you 257,000 farmers have committed suicide frequently drinking the very pesticides that your big company manufactures. I would think that someone in your company should make you aware that 250,000 people have committed suicide because of you. So clearly the message is not getting to you. We'd be happy to sit down and talk with you in depth, politely, always. There's no purpose in, you know, being anything other than thoughtful, courteous, but definitely sharing facts with you that are not in your mindset. So that's the invitation that goes out to Bill Gates today, and you'll hear why he is wrong Monsanto's wrong, the USDA's wrong, the FDA's wrong, the President of the United States wrong. In fact, everyone who supports genetically engineering is wrong on this issue. So we'll get to that. And my guest in the second part of our program will be Professor Michael Clare. That's with a K, K-L-A-R-E. He is professor and director of the Five College Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. We're going to talk about the new geopolitics associated with the global race to lay claim to the planet's last resources, water, land for food, minerals, metals, and fossil fuel reserves. This is a topic that should be discussed in depth because what we're going to talk about actually matters. Not what MSNBC and Oberman, and Fox and all these other people talk about. Not that they don't have a right to talk about it. Not that they cannot articulate their points. Well, each of them can. But how relevant is it? Who controls water, land for food, minerals, metals, and fuels? That is relevant. And it's not being discussed. We'll talk about it. Let's begin. I can remember the first time that I started using high doses of vitamin C intravenous. I would do vitamin C one day and glutathione a different day because one's a prooxidant, one's an antioxidant. And one creates free radicals, which is a byproduct, but also stimulates a massive kill-off of cancer cells and bacteria and viruses in the body. The other helps charge your liver and really gets rid of the toxins. And I remember a physician sitting there and asking me about, well, how high can you go? I said, well, as long as your body can tolerate it and you do it slowly, you can go up easily to 200,000 milligrams. And the sicker you are, the more diseases you have, the less you'll find you spill in the urine because the cells are using it, the body's using it. And I had showed him an article from a doctor down in North Carolina who in the 1960s and early 70s, named Klenner, was using 50,000 milligrams at a time, and that was considered very high. From his work, then a Dr. Robert Cathcart, a brilliant physician, began to use 50,000 milligrams for people with pneumocystis, crenia, and pneumonia, and none of his patients died. He was able to reverse pneumocystis. Not cure AIDS, but reverse the number one killer of persons diagnosed with AIDS. And then when he came to New York and he came by the Institute, he saw the amount I was using and he saw the people and he interviewed the people. He was there for 2 days and he and another physician were interviewing these. Well, how do you feel? Well, let me see your blood workups. And they were all very open and showed him the blood workups. Afterwards, we went out to dinner and this is about 10 o'clock at night because the people with AIDS were working in the evening. They all liked being together. They liked having their own support system, and that was fine. People with cancer came earlier in the day, chronic fatigue syndrome. Kind of people liked to be with other people because when someone started getting better, it gave them all hope. And that's always good. When one person in a room is doing well with breast cancer, it tells the other people in the room there's a chance also that you'll get better. So anyhow, that's how we had signed it. And Cathcart is saying, I've got to get Linus in here, Linus Pauling, who was a friend of Cathcart's, to become aware of the high doses you're all using. And he said, you realize what's going to happen. I said, what's that? He said, you're going to run right up against the quack busters who are in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry. They're nothing but a bunch of, loons. But they're the ones the media, official media talk to. They won't look at the doctors. They won't look at the patients. They never do. They can't afford to. We had this long 4-hour conversation about why, no matter what truth exists, the mainstream media cannot touch it. If in any way what we're sharing challenges the existing paradigm of medicine. And he expected himself to be attacked, which he later was. And I said, surely sooner or later, they're going to realize that intravenous vitamin C is the number one way to treat people with cancer and AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome, hepatitis B and C. It saves lives. We have thousands of people. We can show that. He said, it's irrelevant. They won't look at it. If they do, they'll dismiss it. That's what they've done. Here's the latest. This is from greenmedinfo.com. intravenous vitamin C in cancer. I'll quote this. Irving Stone was an early thinker and writer about vitamin C. He knew it would be an uphill battle to change the way the medical profession viewed vitamin C, and while most doctors accept that scurvy is a vitamin C deficiency illness, few have made the rather humongous jump to seeing high-dose intravenous vitamin C as a major player in the management of cancer. There's actually a wide spectrum of medical uses for vitamin C. Evidence exists documenting it as the best antiviral agent now available. If used at the proper dose, vitamin C can neutralize and eliminate a wide range of toxins. Vitamin C will enhance most resistance, greatly augment the immune system's ability to neutralize bacterial and fungal infections. Now the National Institutes of Health has published evidence demonstrating vitamin C's anti-cancer properties. With so many medical benefits, why do so few doctors know them? One explanation stems from ascorbic acid's designation as a vitamin. Consider Dorland's Illustrated Medical Dictionary definition of vitamin. A general term for a number of unrelated organic substances that occur in many foods in small amounts that are necessary in trace amounts for the normal metabolic function of the body. As a vitamin, only a minuscule 60 milligrams of ascorbic acid is needed to prevent the emergence of scurvy symptoms. As a medical treatment for cancer and life-threatening infections and toxic exposures, tens of thousands of milligrams of ascorbic acid must be administered, often by intravenous as well as oral route. The center's founder, Dr. Hugh Royden, was a true scientist who believed in the power of scientific measurement over dogma. With the establishment of the center in 1975, he routinely checked plasma vitamin C levels in chronically ill patients. He found these sick, virtually all sick patients, to be consistently low in their vitamin C levels. Interestingly enough, the cancer patients he was seeing had very low vitamin C reserves. This matched scientific literature documenting low vitamin C levels in cancer patients. Cancer cells were actively taking up vitamin C in a way that depleted tissue reserves of vitamin C. PET scans are commonly ordered by oncologists to evaluate their cancer patients for metastasis, which means the spread of the cancer to other organs. What is actually injected into the patient at the start of the scan is radioactive glucose. Cancer cells are anaerobic obligates, which means they depend upon glucose as their primary source of metabolic fuel. Cancer cells employ transport mechanisms called glucose transporters to actively pull in glucose. In the vast majority of animals, vitamin C is synthesized from glucose in only four metabolic steps. Hence, the molecular shape of vitamin C is remarkably similar to glucose. Cancer cells will actively transport vitamin C into themselves, possibly mistaking it for glucose. Another plausible explanation is they are using the vitamin C as an antioxidant. Regardless, the vitamin C accumulates in cancer cells. If large enough amounts of vitamin C are present in cancer cells, large amounts will be absorbed in these unusually large concentrations. The antioxidant vitamin C will start behaving as a prooxidant as it interacts with intercellular copper and iron. This chemical interaction produces small amounts of hydrogen peroxide. And because cancer cells are relatively low in an intracellular antioxidant enzyme called catalase, the high-dose vitamin C induction of peroxide will continue to build up until it eventually lyses the cancer cell from the inside out. It kills it. This effectively makes high-dose vitamin C intravenous a non-toxic chemotherapeutic agent that can be given in conjunction with conventional cancer treatments. Based upon the work of several vitamin C pioneers before him, Dr. Royden was able to prove that vitamin C was selectively toxic to cancer cells if given intravenously. The research was recently reproduced and published by Dr. Mark Levine at the National Institutes of Health. As feared by many oncologists, small doses may actually help the cancer cells because small doses of vitamin C may help the cancer cells arm themselves against the free radical-induced damage caused by chemotherapy and radiation. Only higher doses of vitamin C will selectively build up as peroxide in the cancer cells to the point of acting in a major way as chemotherapy. These tumor-toxic dosages of vitamin C can only be obtained by intravenous administration. over a span of 15 years of vitamin C research, Dr. Royden's cancer work team generated 20 published papers in the peer-reviewed literature on vitamin C and cancer. Intravenous vitamin C also does more than just kill cancer cells. It boosts immunity. It can stimulate collagen formation to help the body wall off the tumor. It inhibits an enzyme that tumors use to metabolize and to metastasize and invade other organs throughout the body. It induces apoptosis to help program cancer cells into dying early. It corrects the almost universal scurvy in cancer patients. We all know that cancer patients are tired, listless, bruise easily, and have poor appetite. They don't sleep well and have a low threshold for pain. This adds up to a very classic picture of scurvy that generally goes unrecognized by their conventional physicians. And when cancer patients receive intravenous, they report that their pain level goes down, that they feel better, they're better able to tolerate chemotherapy, they bounce back quicker after intravenous vitamin C, and they bounce back quicker after radiation. So it is very important. So to summarize, most organisms make their own vitamin C when they're under stress, either by illness or injury. Mother Nature has provided them with a means to facilitate healing. They synthesize more ascorbic acid. As a result, they are in less pain. They remain active. They can sleep, and they have a better appetite. All functions which promote healing. So that's from Ron Hunterhake, medical doctor, chief medical officer, Olive Garvey, a Center for Healing Arts. And it was interesting because I'm going to guesstimate that about 4,000 individuals, patients, treated by the medical staff, board-certified physicians, where I created the protocols and sat with the patients every day, 7 days a week, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. There was no question that thousands upon thousands of people improved, lives were saved. Yet when trying to hold a press conference to invite the medical community, the medical writers, Jane Brody, the New York Times, and others, just come and take a look. Spend a day. Talk with the patients, the doctors, look at records. It's all there. Nothing's hidden. No secrets. No magic formula. And the vast majority of the people were treated for free. They were compassionately healed. Nobody was ever turned away. If they did that, we could, based upon the current medical models, I estimate we would save 500,000 lives a year in the United States. 500,000 people could be alive and well and healthy. So it's not the cancer that's the problem, per se. It is the belief systems and the politics of the paradigm that wants absolute control over everything within the healthcare system. And you could say, okay, we give you control. We've given you unlimited amounts of money. We've given you control. But what have you given us as in return? And the answer is a lot of toe-tagged individuals. How many in the last 20 years? 10 million. So when you have all the power in the world, you will not be held accountable for any mistakes made within your paradigm. And you kill 10 million people. Shouldn't someone say, maybe we should look in a different direction? Those outside the paradigm, of course, do. Those inside can't. Next up, this is from Jeremy Lawrence. The age of safe medicine is ending. Oh, I didn't know we had safe medicine. I'll quote this. The world is entering an era where injuries are common, as a child's scratched knee could kill, where patients entering hospital gamble with their lives, and where routine operations such as a hip replacement become too dangerous to carry out. This is according to what was stated on Friday by the head of the World Health Organization. There's a global crisis in antibiotics caused by rapidly evolving resistance among microbes responsible for common infections that threaten to turn them into untreatable diseases. This is according to Dr. Margaret Chan, Director General of the World Health Organization. Addressing a meeting of infectious disease experts in Copenhagen, she said that every antibiotic ever developed was a risk of becoming useless. Quote from her, a post-antibiotic era means, in effect, an end in modern medicine as we know it. Things are common as strep throat or a child's scratched knee could once again kill. Antimicrobial resistance is on the rise. Europe and elsewhere in the world, where we are losing our first-line antimicrobials. Replacement treatments are more costly, more toxic, need much more duration of treatment, and may require treatment in intensive care units. For patients infected with some drug-resistant pathogens, death has been shown to increase by 50%. Some sophisticated interventions like hip replacement, organ transplant, cancer chemotherapy, and care for preterm infants would become far more difficult or even too dangerous to undertake. How bad is it? How about in Britain alone, a 30% rise in the cases of blood poisoning caused by E. coli bacteria? And that's a whole lot of people. Now, what does this mean to us, the people in this audience? Well, first, the average American has a toxic immune system to begin with. Their colons are toxic. Their livers are toxic. Their blood is toxic. They have a lot of DNA defects, and yet they continue to make improper choices. For those of you listening to this program, the vast majority of you, I'm sure, are making as healthy choices as you can. You're building up your immune system so that when you do confront a pathogen, at the very least, your body is strong enough, your immune resistance strong enough that it doesn't take hold. And if you should get sick, I'm sure that you immediately go towards your emergency natural medicine cabinet, be it homeopathic, colloidal silver, gold colloidals, tea tree oil, all the different things topically or internally that we take in measured amounts under supervision so that we can kill these pathogens and not harm the body, and then flooding the body with the juices and the probiotics. And then if that doesn't work, then, of course, intravenous ozone, which will kill almost every bacterium and virus and cancer cells but not harm the body. Hence, it does not cause antibiotic resistance. This is simple. They refuse to get this message, but now they know their problem. They're dead-ended. They've got this gigantic medical-industrial complex like a roaring train going off the cliff. And they're filled with such hubris and ignorance and arrogance, they refuse to change anything. But just remember, first line, you help yourself. There's 1,000 things we could do to help ourselves. Secondly, ozone. Third, intravenous aqueous vitamin A with, on separate days, not the same day, glutathione, and then intravenous vitamin C. Then homeopathic zeolites. You give that, you could stop most of the pathogens we would be affected by. And then, of course, you're practicing proper hygiene. You're spraying surface areas. You're cleaning your hands. You're realizing, you and everyone else, you're touching your face about 2,000 times a day. And if your fingers are contaminated, then you can infect yourself. So proper hygiene would save us a lot of problems. And then probiotics. And, you know, they're treating people with massive amounts of antibiotics, never giving a probiotic. So the person has no good bacteria, but the harmful ones that are killed grow back. Now they're resistant. You think that maybe some of the best and brightest out of Albert Einstein, some of these other schools, just haven't figured these basics out? Well, sooner or later, this paradigm will collapse. And when it does, since it certainly will never be reformed, they're not open to any suggestions because they've been indoctrinated. And they're indoctrinated with the deep, dark sleep of the truly committed. These are cultists. American medicine is nothing more than a gigantic cult today. And the only place it works, and works admirably, and I commend it for it, is in emergency medicine. Everything else, it fails completely, but worse than that, it fails with a deadly outcome. I'm Gary Knoll. Now to our commentary, then you'll have a chance to call in, then we'll go to our guest. I'm concerned that the American media have done a magnificent job. They really have done a four-star job of promoting American exceptionalism. that we are the most unique, exceptional nation in the history of the world, that if we enter a conflict zone, it is only with the purest of intent to bring liberty, democracy, freedom for women and the oppressed. And that when a mistake occasionally is made, on rare occasion, where it cannot be covered up, then we'll apologize for the collateral damage. But then immediately redouble down that we're not leaving. Because if we leave now, and all you have to do is listen to the President of the United States and what he said last week, and John McCain endorsing it, then our mission would not be complete. And of course, our purpose is to make sure our mission is complete. And look at the success of our missions in Vietnam, for example. That was a successful mission. We brought peace and liberty in to Vietnam, and we didn't hurt the citizens, did we? We have zero sense of history. I did a five-part series on this called Intervention. It was a scholarly, honest look at the fact that we have never gone into a conflict zone unless we had some ulterior motive, with massive consequences that were devastating to citizens and anyone pro-unionist, pro-democracy. We actually did just the opposite. If you were for democracy, we made sure that we gave money to, whether it is the Israeli government, the Egyptian government, the Bahrain government, the Saudi government, and all the other governments in the Middle East or around the world or in South America, we made sure that you then were targeted, more often than not assassinated, rendered useless, or in the case of Chile, taken in planes, full planes out into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and then thrown out with your feet shackled. Lots of people disappeared, all under our direct training at the School of the Americas. Yet none of this is ever brought up. None of the truth is ever explained of what really goes on in war. And so, unfortunately, the American public, at least those who choose actively to be in denial, because you have to be understanding, if the average adaptive supportive American, which is about 80% of Americans, if they actually had to open themselves up, detach themselves from the belief system and say, what is the truth of this action? Is the world a better place? Are the people in this country a better off? Is the environment better off? Did we really bring anything measurably beneficial to the people of that country? The answer is, we never have. Not since the Second World War. They have all, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, Grenada, just look at our, and Iraq, Afghanistan, Iraq twice. The devastation level to civilians is incredible. Chris Hedges, with a war in Afghanistan, where the enemy is elusive and rarely seen, where the culture and linguistic disconnect makes every trip outside the wire a visit to hostile territory, where it is clear that you are losing despite the vast industrial killing machine at your disposal. That feeds the culture of atrocity. The fear and stress, the anger and hatred reduce all Afghans, all of them, to being looked at as the enemy. And this includes women, children, the elderly. Civilians and combatants merge into one detested, nameless, faceless mass. The psychological leap to murder them is short. And murder happens every day in Afghanistan. It happens in drone strikes, artillery bombardments, air strikes, missile attacks, and the withering, suppressing fire unleashed in villages from belt-fed machine guns. Military attacks like these in civilian areas make discussion of human rights an absurdity. Robert Bales, a U.S. Army staff sergeant who allegedly killed 16 civilians in two Afghan villages, including 9 children, he's not an anomaly. He's not one bad apple. To decry the butchery of this case and to defend the wars of occupation we wage is to know nothing about combat. We kill children nearly every day in Afghanistan. We don't usually kill them outside the structured military unit. If an American soldier had killed or wounded scores of civilians after the ignition of an improvised explosion device against his convoy, it would not be made into news. Units do not stick around to count their collateral damage. But the Afghans know. They hate us for the murderous rampages. They hate us for our hypocrisy. The scale of our state-sponsored murder is masked from public view. Reporters who travel with military units and become psychologically part of the team spin out what the public and their military handlers want. the mythic tales of heroism and valor. The war is seen only through the lens of occupiers. It is defended as a national virtue. Did you ever hear Bill O'Reilly and all the other talking head war, pro-war pundits and Geraldo Rivera? They spin this. This myth allows us to make sense of the man and the death. It justifies what is usually nothing more than gross human cruelty, brutality, and stupidity. It allows us to believe we have achieved our place in human society because of a long chain of heroic endeavors, rather than accept the sad reality that we stumble along a dimly lit corridor of disasters. It disguises our powerlessness. It hides from view the impotence and ordinariness of our leaders. But in turning history into myth, we transform random events into a sequence of events directed by a will greater than our own, one that is determined and preordained. We are elevated above the multitude. We march to nobility. But it is also a lie. And it is a lie that combat veterans carry within them. It is why so many commit suicide. Quote, I too belong to this species, J. Glenn Gray wrote of his experience in World War II. I'm ashamed not only of my own deeds, not only of my nation's deeds, but of human deeds as well. I'm ashamed to be a man. End quote. When Ernie Pyle, the famous World War II correspondent, was killed on the Pacific Island in 1945, a rough draft of a column was found on his body. He was preparing it for release upon the end of the war in Europe. He had done much to promote the myth of the warrior and the nobility of soldiering, but by the end of the war, he seemed to have tired of it all. Quote, but there are many of the living who have burned into their brains forever the unnatural sight of cold, dead men scattered over the hillsides and in the ditches, along the high rows of hedges throughout the world. Dead men by mass production, in one country after another, month after month, year after year. Dead men in winter and dead men in summer. Dead men in such familiar promiscuity that they become monotonized. Dead men in such monstrous infinity that you come almost to hate them. These are the things you at home need not try to understand. To you at home, they are columns of figures, where he is in a near one who went away and just didn't come back. You didn't see him lying so grotesque and pasty beside the gravel road in France. We saw him by the multiple thousands. That's the difference. There is a constant search in all wars to find new perversities, new forms of death when the initial flush fades, a rear guard and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. This is why during the war in El Salvador, the death squads and the soldiers would cut off the genitals of those they had killed and stuff them in their mouths of the corpses. This is why we reporters in Bosnia would find bodies crucified on the side of barns or decapitated. This is why the U.S. Marines had urinated on dead Taliban fighters. Those slain in combat are treated as trophies by their killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. It happened in every war that I covered. War perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physically. It destroys the continuity of life, tearing apart all systems, economic, social, environmental, and political, that sustain us as human beings. In war, we deform ourselves of our essence. We give up individual conscious, maybe even at all levels, for contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extreme, to make a moral choice to defy war's enticement, can in the culture of war be self-destructive. The essence of war is death. Taste enough of war and you become to a point, do you believe the Stoics were right? We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. A World War II study determined that after 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of all surviving soldiers will have become psychiatric casualties. A common trait among the remaining 2% was a predisposition towards having an aggressive psychopathic personality. Lieutenant Colonel Davis Grossman, in his book on killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill and War in Society, notes, "It is not too far from the mark to observe that there is something about continuous inescapable combat which will drive 98% of all men insane, and the other 2% were crazy when they got there." During the war in El Salvador, many soldiers served for 3 or 4 years or longer, as in the United States wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, until they psychologically or physically collapsed. In garrison towns, commanders banned the sale of sedatives because those drugs were abused by the troops. In that war, as in the wars in the Middle East, the emotionally and psychologically maimed were common. I once interviewed a 19-year-old Salvadoran army sergeant who had spent 5 years fighting and then suddenly lost his vision after his unit walked into a rebel ambush. The rebels killed 11 of his fellow soldiers in the firefight, including his closest friend. He was unable to see again until he was placed in an army hospital. "I had these horrible headaches," he told me as he sat on the edge of his bed. "There is a shrapnel in my head. I keep telling the doctors to take it out, but the doctors told me that there are no head wounds." I saw other soldiers in other conflicts go deaf or mute or shake without being able to stop. War is necrophilia, Mr. President Obama. It is necrophilia, sir. This necrophilia that you promote and you worship to is central to soldiering, just as it is to central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. The necrophilia is hidden under platitudes about duty and comradeship. It is unleashed especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its highest pitch. When we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our destruction. In his memoir, Wartime, about the partisan war in Yugoslavia, the author wrote of the enticement that death held for the combatants. He stood over the body of his comrade, a commander, and found dying did not seem terrible or unjust. This was the most extraordinary, the most exalted moment of my life. Death did not seem strange or undesirable. That I restrained myself from charging blindly into the fray and death was perhaps due to my sense of obligation to the troops or to some comrade's reminder concerning the task at hand. In my memory, I returned to those moments many times with the same feeling of intimacy with death and desire for it while I was in prison, especially during my first incarceration. War ascendant wipes out eros. It wipes out delicacy and tenderness. Its communal power seeks to render the individual obsolete, to hand all passions, all choice, all voice to the crowd. The most important part of the individual life, which cannot be subsumed in communal life, is love. Which was from Sebastian Hafner, who wrote in Defying Hitler. So comradeship has its special weapons against love. Every evening in bed after the last patrol round, there was the ritual reciting of lewd songs and jokes. That is the hard and fast rule of male camaraderie, and nothing is more mistaken than the widely held opinion that this is a safety valve for frustration or erotic or sexual feelings. These songs and jokes do not have an erotic arousing effect. On the contrary, they make the act of love appear as unappetizing as possible. They treat it like digestion and defecation and make it an object of ridicule. The men who recited rude songs and used coarse language for female body parts were in effect denying that they ever had tender feelings or had been in love, that they had ever made themselves attractive. Behave gently. When we see this, when we see our addiction for what it is, when we understand ourselves and how war has perverted us, life becomes hard to bear. John Steele, a cameraman who spent years in war zones, had a nervous breakdown in a crowded Heathrow airport after returning from Sarajevo. Steele had come to understand the reality of his work, a reality that stripped away the self-righteous, high-octane gloss. When he was in the war area, he was in a place called Sniper's Alley, and I filmed a girl there who had been hit in the neck by a sniper's bullet. I filmed her in the ambulance, and only after she was dead, I suddenly understood that the last thing she had seen was the reflection of the lens of the camera I was holding in front of her. This wiped me out. I grabbed the camera and started running down Sniper's Alley, filming at knee level, the Bosnians running from place to place. Year after the end of the war in Bosnia, I sat with Bosnian friends who had suffered horribly. A young woman had lost her father, a Serb who refused to join the besieging Serb forces around the city. A few days earlier, she had to identify his corpse. The body was lifted, water running out of the sides of a rotting coffin, from a small park for reburial in the center of the cemetery. Soon she would immigrate to Australia, where she told me, "I will marry a man who has never heard of this war and raise children that will be told nothing about it, nothing about this country I am from." She was young, but in war, it had extracted a toll. Her cheeks were hollow, her hair dry and brittle, her teeth were decayed, and some had broken into jagged pieces. She had no money for a dentist. She hoped to have her teeth fixed in Australia. Yet all she and her friends did that afternoon was lament the days when they lived in fear and hunger, emaciated and targeted by Serb gunners on the heights above. They did not wish back any suffering. And yet, they admitted, those may have been the fullest days of their lives. What they expressed was disillusionment with a sterile, futile, and empty present. Peace had again exposed the void that the rush of war, a battle, had filled. Once again they were, as perhaps we all are, alone, no longer bound by a common struggle, no longer given the opportunity to be noble and heroic, no longer sure of what life it was about, what it was meant to be. The old camaraderie, however false, had vanished with the last shot. Moreover, they had seen that all the sacrifice had been for naught. They had been, as well as we all are and more, betrayed. The corrupt old Communist Party bosses who became nationalists overnight and got them into the mess in the first place had grown rich off their suffering and were still in power. And yet those who had fought faced 70% unemployment. They depended on handouts from the international community. They understood that their cause, once as fashionable in certain intellectual circles as they were themselves, lay forgotten. No longer did actors, politicians, and artists scramble to visit during the ceasefires, acts that were almost always gross self-promotion. They knew the lie of war, the mockery of their idealism, the struggle with their shattered illusions, and yet they wished it all back. Later, I received a Chrisman card, and it was signed by her, and no return address, never heard from her again. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, Chris Hedges. I'm concerned that today, look at the video games. The most popular video games in the United States are ones that glorify violence, that allow you in the safety and the existential existence of the hyper-reality space to kill, to maim at will. And how is this supposed to sensitize us to a higher morality, a higher ethic, a higher love of people, a higher understanding that we are all connected? Please explain that to me. And we accept that the man who had led many of the carnage campaigns is now our Secretary of the Defense and our Secretary of the CIA. Two people changed places, but these were the architects that carried on before them. And a president who refuses to have the American media go into the homes of those who are the casualties, the children, the men and women, and see what it is like for them, the occupied, to live in this environment, and that we never shed a tear for them, and the American media never shows us their plight. I'm Gary Knoll. Your thoughts. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. My guest is on hold. We're going to go to Professor Michael Clare in a moment to talk about the new geopolitics associated with the global race to lay claim to the planet's last resources, fossil fuel reserves, water, land for food, minerals, and metals. As I mentioned at the beginning of our program, Professor Clare is a professor and director of the Five College Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He has written extensively about U.S. military policy, international peace affairs, global arms trade, and the politics behind natural resources and energy. He is currently the defense correspondent for The Nation magazine and serves on the board of the Arms Control Association. And he is the author of The Race for What's Left. Professor Clare, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Gary.
I'm very concerned that the average American is unaware that some of the largest financial movements with capital today from hedge funds and investment banks is to make sure that they can control, without any interference, the world's remaining finite resources. Water, for example, soil. Could you take us through what happens when we first are in denial that we've passed peak oil, deny that we pass peak water, and deny that we pass peak food production because we have adulterated so much of and mismanaged so much of the world's soil, and yet there are people who say whatever's left, we're going to control it. Take us through this journey, please.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is the subject of my new book, The Race for What's Left, which gives you a sense of what's on my mind, and the argument is that most of the existing reservoirs of the resources on which we depend, the ones you described, Gary, food, water, land, minerals, and oil, most of the easy supplies, the readily accessible supplies of those are now depleted. There's still stuff out there, but it's much harder to get out of the ground to process into usable things, like, you know, Canadian tar sands. There's a lot of Canadian tar sands, but it's very costly to process and very environmentally hazardous to produce and to deliver. That's what's left on the planet for us to depend on. And the giant corporations, like you say, are fighting amongst themselves for control over these last remaining resources because that's all there is. And they need them to maintain their flow of profits. And we're going to see now, I believe, in the years and decades ahead, an intense cutthroat competition for what remains of the world's resources.
So if I understand what you're saying, sir, there's a difference between easy oil, which we've gotten up to this point, where we can drill down and get it, versus rough oil, which is still abundant but very expensive and very risky to the environment, digging in the Arctic, digging in the deepest parts of the ocean, and which is not easy to get to, which is massively expensive, which is by its very nature, the costs involved when they do extract it, it's going to end up costing a lot more, which means a lot of the things we take for granted today, from toaster ovens to hair dryers to the tires on our cars to the fuel in our vehicles, that's all going to cost more. It is inevitable that this cost is passed on to us. Is that an accurate assessment?
You did a very good job. Yes, exactly. We've been drilling into the earth and digging into the earth and abusing the planet Earth for a very long time. And we've reached the point where anything that's within reach, within easy reach of humans, has now been depleted, has been exhausted, put to use, consumed, and is gone forever. So everything that's left is either far deep underground or far offshore or far in the north in the Arctic, and getting it out of the ground is going to be exceedingly difficult and costly using very invasive technologies like hydrofracking, hydraulic fracturing, or deep offshore using these very expensive rigs like the Deepwater Horizon and entailing great risk, as we saw in the Gulf of Mexico. And today we're learning that similar risks are emerging in Brazil's offshore fields, which are promised, we're told, to be the next best thing, the next greatest thing, the next big source of oil, even more risky than in the Gulf of Mexico.
Now, we appear to be in a serious catch-22 with respect to pushing forward with alternative energies and technologies to reduce fossil fuel consumption, because many of these technologies, in turn, rely heavily upon other resources that are reaching their peak as well. Certain metals, such as platinum and rare metals for hybrid cars and new generations of fuel cells and wind turbines and solar panels, also have to be mined, and we're past peak in those as well. And they're even in conflict zones like the Congo, which has led to a lot of slaughter there. Could you explain that to us?
Well said, yes. A lot of what's left are located either in war zones, as you say, the DR Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Afghanistan has lots of minerals and possibly oil and natural gas. And we could well see companies moving in there if there's ever security. I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon, so I think there'll be continuing violence in Afghanistan or in Iraq over what little can be extracted from those countries. And elsewhere, as you say, the new technologies that we're turning to rely on, like wind power and solar power, hybrid cars, and hydrogen fuel cells, these rely on a whole range of very exotic minerals, the so-called rare earths, lithium, and others that are quite scarce. And to acquire them will entail very invasive technologies, costly, energy demanding, and result in new geopolitical fights.
I'm going to tie my last two questions together for you, if you would, please. I believe that we should ban all trading, commodity trading, not just trading, but commodity trading, where people are not actually taking possession and using the commodities. They're manipulating the price of anything essential to life, water, gas, oil, food. And yet, the most powerful incentives right now are for major sovereign funds and hedge funds to go into Africa to buy up large tracts of land, displace the people there so they can control that land either for speculating in foods that people will need at some point in the future or to create that food to bring back into their own countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and which don't have capacity to create that food. That sets off the potential for a global race for the procurement of farmlands. I see that as possibly in the near future becoming highly contentious. And finally, when you have this limited amount of resources, there's going to be conflicts. Where do you see the highest probability for these conflicts with natural resources, including food, occurring?
My gosh. Well, first, Gary, thanks. You clearly have read my book carefully, because you allude to all of these things that I write about. I'm especially distressed by the phenomenon called land grabs that you describe, of these hedge funds buying up land in Africa and the countries like rich countries like Saudi Arabia buying up agricultural land in Africa to produce food for export while people in those countries are starving to death. I find that especially despicable. And yet we see a lot of this taking place. And typically, they're going into areas where the governments involved, the Ethiopian government, the Sudanese government, the Kenyan government, claims that these are uninhabited areas. But in fact, they are inhabited often by traditional peoples, herders, sheep herders, cattle herders, who have been living there for centuries but don't have legal title to the land, can't claim it. And so the government comes in and sweeps them off the land, and this leads to violence. And this is beginning to break out throughout Africa. We just don't hear about it very much, but it's happening in Ethiopia and Sudan and Zimbabwe on a fairly widespread scale.
I just think that we need to have open dialogues on this. We're out of time for our program. Thank you very much, Professor Michael Clare, for the important work you do, including the race for what's left.
Thank you.
And finally, for those of you listening tonight at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we will be taking on the entire environmental establishment. It's time that we, the grassroots, took back power they have betrayed us, they've lied to us, they've manipulated us, they sold out. We're going to take it back. You won't want to miss that Progressive Radio Hour, 7 p.m. Now, I'm going to invite Richard Gale to come in studio and give you a coming attraction of programs that we're going to be having on this week, and Myron also to come into our studio and give you the latest on our new website. And let's start with Myron. Hi, Myron.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Myron, we have a brand new Progressive Radio Network website. We knew it'd take us a couple weeks to work the kinks out. Tell us about what makes this site different than our previous one, what some of the issues are that we're still working through, and how people who might not be able to get all the downloads or get access can.
Well, what we're hoping to do with the new website is to really bring together in a more meaningful way all of our shows, all of our archives, and really just tighten things up and really show people what we're about rather than going to a bunch of different websites for each show. We want them all to come to our one website and have everything right there in front of them, the videos, the articles, and all the shows that are related to every subject, so we can really empower people to get that information and to do something about it.
Good. Now, today we have... Is Richard Gale in studio with you?
Yeah.
Hi,
good.
Gary.
Today we have a major campaign that we're just doing what we call a soft approach with first. We're taking on the issue of helping all of our 30 million veterans in the United States, by extension, their family, many of whom have had such challenges because they've been injured, psychologically damaged. They're not being helped by the government. The government's been in complete denial. And so we have done a new documentary. I want people to look at the people's reactions as they come out of a theater. Uncoached, they just came out. We had a camera and we said, what do you think of the film? Watch this. Then watch a trailer of the film, which Richard Polonesky and one of our executive producers put together. And then you'll see this 2-hour and 15-minute film is available there. Also, there are two articles, one written by Richard Gale myself about Gulf War veterans drop dead. That's the message from our United States government. And also one written by myself and Dr. Nancy, Gulf War Syndrome, by Mitzi on our staff, one of our research scholars, Gulf War Syndrome, an American Tragedy. These are two separate articles showing the plight of the Gulf War vets, what they go through, plus organizations people can go to. So if you go to Progressive Radio Network, what should they go to watch the trailer and read the articles and look at all the work that's being done to help the vets?
They can go to PRN.fm, the homepage, and we're going to feature one of those articles at the top of the page. If they scroll down just a little bit, they'll see the article and a picture, and that'll be their portal to all the information that they need. All the videos will be there if you just, click on the vets issues.
Good, and these are original documentaries. These are hard-hitting documentaries. I only had a chance to premiere once in New York City last Monday night to a packed house, and I want to thank all the people who were there in the theater for showing it, and then once Sunday before out in Long Island. But there won't be any more showings in the near future because we're off, and I'm on my 20-state trip of interviewing senior citizens around the United States on the plight of getting old in America and what are your challenges, how are you coping, and what do you need. So I give them a voice and bring their voice to our attention. Richard Gale. Richard, and by the way, thanks, Myron, for the good work you're doing there to make our site a snap.
Thank you, Gary, for the opportunity.
And we have thousands and thousands of people every day, brand new people coming to the site. And what's nice is we have a lot of young people coming and who are tuning in, reading the articles. We have hundreds of articles posted every single week, sometimes dozens and dozens in a given 24-hour period. I hire people to work all night who do nothing but look around the world for the most important articles involving progressive issues. And that's what you read up there, the articles. And very shortly, in the near future, I'm starting a whole documentary channel, and more on that coming up.
Richard, one last thing, Gary. I just wanted to say the people that are having issues, we definitely empathize with you. We know that there is a certain server issue. We didn't expect this huge amount of people, the new people coming to the site. So that was on us. So basically, if just reload the page if it doesn't load up correctly, and those issues should be a thing of the past by the end of this week.
Didn't we also have something like 40-some thousand people immediately come over and just blow our site out?
Exactly right.
I mean, how many people have 40,000 people come instantly to a site? No one expected that. But then you got to look at the numbers of new people listening to Progressive Radio Network, the fastest growing internet radio in the world.
And with no marketing budget,
none.
You know, really.
Word of mouth. Richard Gale.
Yes, Gary, how are you?
Richard,
doing?
Tell us about tonight's show and then give us a preview of this week's guest.
Sure. Derek Jensen's going to be returning, and who's really one of our nation's leading voices, especially from the younger generation on cultural environmental dissent, one of Whitney Reader's top 50 visionaries of the world. So, and Thomas Lindsay, who was he was admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court. He served on several of the circuit court's appeals, and the founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. He really is there to empower grassroots environmental movements and to really expose the over-hierarchical, bureaucratic red tape of the larger environmental organizations that are now pretty much in cahoots with large corporate polluters like the oil companies and Monsanto in particular. I think this program's going to expose these environmental groups like the World Wildlife Fund and all with their pants down on what they've been doing for decades. And then in the future, we've got Ken Delvecchio is going to be coming on as a guest. He's an independent candidate you just met with recently. He'll be running for Senator for the state of New Jersey. And,
well, I want to do this. You arranged for me to meet with him. I don't have politicians on the program, with rare exception, and I don't have them on because they're running for something. I have them on because we want to see how their positions impact us, especially those who have not compromised, like Ron Paul we had on, and Dennis Kucinich we had on, and Alan Grayson we had on. Those we had on, just those three, because I believe that they have a higher principles of integrity. You can take issue with some of their points, and I certainly do, but overall, we're all on the same page about being out of wars, and that's why we have them on. But I'm also looking for the next group of people who want to hold public office, but who I believe have to have a progressive, populist point of view. So I invited him in, and we spent 2 hours, and if you were in the room, you'd have thought he was being interrogated. No spin. Tell me what you have on 40 issues. And on 38 of 40 issues, he came down on the side of progressive values. Only on two did he not. And that's fine. But he'll be on because we need to start getting some people who are third-party people into positions so they can start to make a difference before the next five-year cycle. This is something we can do this year, especially from New Jersey, which is notorious for electing hacks and political insiders to Congress. Look at Corzine, who was in Congress and then governor. Now look at him. Look what he did, head of Goldman Sachs. That same mindset was right through his whole tenure. We need people who really care about people. And I believe Kenneth is just a very decent, ethical human being. We've looked into his background. And when you, the public, find people who you believe should be given a form, let Richard Gale know, and Richard will start doing the background check to make sure that this not a there's no wolf in sheep's clothing, that we really have people that represent our interest, the American public's interest, and we will have them on. But first, they go through a whole vetting process. Okay, Richard, what else?
Yes, and Susan Humphreys, Dr. Susan Humphreys, will hopefully be passing through here. She'll be in the studio, we're catching her early before her new recent book, which is going to be very devastating to the pro-vaccine industry. She's given us an opportunity to look at some of the chapters, and you've read them yourself, Gary.
Brilliant insights she offers. Brilliant.
And we're trying to help her find a publisher to make sure this book gets out. And I'm going to bring on this. We're going to have an interesting guest, Professor David Haskell from University of Kentucky. This is a little more in the spiritual environmental side, but he and his students looked at studied in depth, microscopes, everything, just a square meter of land in an old forest of Appalachia. And just to draw all the interconnections of the minutest scale of life of plants and fungi, and then to bring that into perspective in, you know, our own lives on this web of the planet that we rely upon and our effects. And it was just an absolutely fascinating year that he did.
Finish the week.
Well, and then we need some time for you, Gary, to you've got plenty of commentaries and there's plenty of issues, so we'll just be going along the week.
The day I don't have a guest, I will do part two of our politics and medicine, pimping for Big Pharma, the FDA.
Okay.
So that's our week. And once again, take a look at all the other people out there in the media, the radio shows, television shows, listen to the talking heads, all from these think tanks, or all some, you know, author and a tour. We never have that. We try to have people that represent the best interests of all people. We never say that you should be excluded because of your politics, your ethnicity, your religious background, your gender. None of that is relevant to us. All that's relevant to us when Richard Gale's seeking out the best guests, we're reviewing the topics, is will this empower you? Are you better off having listened to this hour or not? Can you take something away that can give you a fundamental shift in consciousness? That's what we are doing every single day. So tonight, 7 p.m., right here, Progressive Commentary. Now, I'm sorry we went over our time into their time, but we have two remarkable people standing by to share a whole lot of good information on it, on the issues that matter to people, especially on health issues. So let's say hello to Lynn and Vicki Saputo, Prescriptions for Health. Lynn and Vicki, we look forward to your show coming up right now.